It's 7 a.m. meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chips Speakers Meeting at the NABBA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Zach E. Is a guy that I've known about 4 years now. And the first time I ran into him, it was raining, and we'd just gotten out of a meeting in Gainesville, downtown Gainesville, and I was having problems with, a blinker or something with my car, and I was struggling in the rain trying to get it fixed, and he had been in the same meeting, and he came running up, and without an umbrella or anything else, he just had to help me out. And he felt sorry for the old guy. And you know what? He got the car taken care of. And he wouldn't take anything besides have a good day. And I said, wow, what an angel. That guy was awesome. And so that Friday night, I told my story down and at the Winner's Circle, Saturday night. It's a Saturday night meeting at Chamblee Dunwoody Methodist Church. And I told my story, and his brother picks up a 2-year chip that night. And then I noticed Zach was in the room. And when it was all over with, I invited Zach to come tell his story at NABBA. And he said, well, maybe I will, but I got 2 days in the program. And he just picked up a white chip. So here he is 4 years later telling his story. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you all for having me. I want to amend that story. I think all I did was hand you a wrench, and I went back and like sat in the car in the dry while he worked on it and came back and handed me the wrench when he was done.
Whatever it was,
I don't remember it. But I do remember that. So like Tim was saying, a little over 4 years ago, I picked up a white chip, hopefully for the last time in my life. It was 4 years and 9 days ago. January 11th is my sobriety date. The night before, I was booked and I spent the night in DeKalb County. I got, like, hopefully, what will be the last DUI of my life. I'm going to get away from trying to tell this thing chronologically because I feel like that's always like going to turn into a drunkalog. I've gotten to tell my story a couple different times, and I've told a drunkalog a time or two. And I just like to clear the air, and I really, as I look around, I see people, and I think, man, they've got real alcoholism, they've got real recovery. You need to do a good enough job, and I've heard people tell their stories, and I think, you know, your story needs to be as good as that story was, because I've certainly heard some very inspiring, very powerful stories of recovery, and my story is good enough as it is tonight. I don't have to dress it up or present it in any kind of light. What I got is enough. And that's something I struggled with before I ever came in these rooms. From a very young age, You know, like, again, I'm going to try to get away from the chronological thing, but you have to qualify yourself, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Grew up in a divorced family, and, you know, I was broken. I was damaged goods. I went to other boys' houses, you know, to play and stuff, and their mom and dad got along. My mom and dad hated each other. You know, if you put them around each other when they would, like, switch me off, you know, for, what is it? Not custody, but, you know, visitation or whatever, you know, like, man, it'd be a fight. And, anyways, felt very broken, you know, starting with that, you know, felt this damaged goods feeling. And as I got older, I was a short kid in class, and I had, you know, the chip on the shoulder. And then these feelings to me from listening to stories and being around these rooms, you know, what I've heard over the years is the same feelings that people have way before the alcohol ever is in somebody's hand, before they're having their first drunk. You know, these feelings I feel like are common, and I've felt a lot of what y'all have told me about in these rooms, but certainly feeling like damaged goods, feeling less than, having that chip on my shoulder, having, you know, naturally what I bring to the table is not enough. I have to compensate. I have to bring something extra because, you know, if y'all see me for who I really am, I'm not as much. I'm less than, and that's something I'm just still getting over one day at a time. And like I say, I mean, I can bring that right up here to a podium telling my story. You know, going on through school, my first drunk, you know, I snuck beers and stuff out of my grandparents' refrigerator and, you know, caught a buzz in sixth grade. I really didn't get drunk. Like, I really got drunk the first time I drank liquor. But, you know, to me, it was harmless. You know, we did the whole thing where you lie. I spent the night at my grandparents. My cousin and her friends spent the night at my grandparents, and we drank some beer, and I, you know, had my first sexual encounter with a girl, and my life was going to be like the beer commercials. I couldn't wait to grow up and be a man and drink more beer and have more sexual encounters with women. Like, this was going to be great. It's not how it went the rest of the way. The first time I got really drunk, similar thing, you know, lying, was over at a friend's house, and we had snuck some vodka over to, you know, spend the night party or something. We had, you know, the parents were on to the whatever kind of scam we had going. The parents were on to it, but we had that bottle of vodka, and that thing was like Excalibur or something. Like, I had to get into that for whatever reason. And when I drank that stuff, it was the nastiest stuff I'd ever tasted. You know, it was like trying to drink bug spray. Yeah, I mean, I remember it was so nasty. But I think what's interesting about that, or what I really distinctly remember, is when I began to drink, I didn't have the feeling of, like, the guilt melting away. The release from boredom is always something that I really loved. And I felt the release from boredom, but I was just automatic. The way that I drank that night, drinking that vodka, was the way I would drink 1,500 more times, you know, before my last drunk, probably at least 1,500 more times, probably getting drunk, not just, you know, having a beer or something. I just, when I start to drink, that's all I do. I just drink and drink and drink till I can't drink anymore. I don't know any other way. I can't do it any other way. I have tried so many times to not just drink into oblivion. And I drank for oblivion for the first time. Just like it says in the book, I had no idea I was that kind of drinker. I had no idea that was alcoholism. That's just the way I was. From the first night I drank that bottle of vodka in a Gatorade bottle when I was 14 or 15 years old, I was going to drink that thing until it was done. And it didn't make any sense to do anything otherwise. It was so very automatic, I guess. So anyways, you know, go to high school. Y'all know how it goes. I mean, more drinking, more parties. I always got caught. You know, you had all the tricks, you know, eat a bag of Doritos, mom won't smell your breath, that kind of stuff. I got caught every time because I got so hammered every time. I was shit-faced every single time I tried to, you know, go out and come home. And so I was in the rooms of AA in Gainesville when I was 18 years old. My parents, the idea was, you're going to go to AA and you're going to see what it's like to be an alcoholic, and you're going to straighten out, mister, or you're going to be one of those losers. That was kind of like the idea, you know, well, it didn't work. I was an alcoholic from the beginning. And so I, you know, had a step grandmother. She was struggling with substance abuse, other forms of alcohol. She was seeing, you know, like the family shrink or whatever, and she, you know, come along with me. Let's talk about your substance abuse problem. And I remember this counselor saying to me when I was 18 years old. He said, "Zach, you know, there's people who they'll drink some of a beer and they'll leave some in the bottle and they'll go and mow the lawn, or they'll go do whatever the hell else they're going to do with the rest of their day." And I knew what he was saying to me back when I was 18. I was nowhere ready to surrender to that, but I knew exactly what he was saying. He was suggesting I had an alcohol problem, and I guess I knew I was powerless over alcohol that long ago. I'm almost 33 years old now, but back when I was 18, I knew exactly what he was trying to get across to me. I was about to go to college, man. There was no way I was stopping yet. I've always known I'm powerless. I guess I'm fast forwarding to the steps, but admitting unmanageability is what I did not want to do. I was very afraid of it, continue to be afraid of this program, what it can do to me, what I'll become if I abandon my alcoholism, my character defects. There's some non-approved literature, Drop a Rock. It describes the hole in the donut. I'm very afraid to this day of becoming a hole in a donut if I don't have, you know, those age-old defects that I believe are my makeup. That's who I am. I'm not really that. You know, I'm a beloved child of God and always have been. And it's so great that I don't have to drink anymore. Anyways, where were we? High school, AA. I was very afraid to surrender to this program, to admit unmanageability, because I was afraid of what this thing was going to do to me. I was very afraid of what the steps were going to do to me, what I would look like without not being an alcoholic anymore. Because although it was messy, it was dangerous, it was really scary, being an alcoholic was all I knew. Being a drunk was all I knew. And it was comfortable. And so, anyways, I did not ever want to admit unmanageability and let this program, let a sponsor go to work on me. College, same old thing. You know, I began to be out of character. I've been raised to be this person. I've got a good family. Like I say, my mom and dad were divorced. They couldn't get along, but loving family. I feel like I was raised very well. A lot of love. I knew what was right to do. And I thought, you know, like identifying, like, I guess, I can't remember if it's Jim or Fred, but I thought I was a perfectly great guy in every respect except in my response to alcohol. And I was just a total drunk. And I just didn't get it. And So I began to really act out of character in college. Other substances were an issue for me back in high school. I mean, from the rip, anything that made me feel different, especially that release from boredom, man. I mean, let's get into something. That was me. I was ready to party at all times. And, you know, those problems, of course, exacerbated along with alcoholism usually, you know. When I was using one, I was using the other, or substituting one for the other. But I was out of character from this person I've been raised to be. I developed a reputation as a scumbag, as a skeezball. I was very much like a mooch and a sponge. I thought I was one step ahead of everybody else with my schemes, my manipulation, my designs. I really wasn't. I thought I was, but I mean, I was the friend that, you know, people didn't want me around. Zach, you know, we don't want you around tonight. You know, we know your game. You know, I would attempt to take as much as I could from everybody because all my money would be spent up. I'd spend all my money, but I still had to, you know, use alcohol. I had to use alcohol. I had to use other forms of alcohol the way I felt I needed to get by. And people were, you know, just something I had to, you know, manipulate in order to get what I needed. I was not in character. People do all kinds of things out of character when they're really effed up, and I don't need to tell y'all that. Y'all know how it is. Y'all probably have your own stories, but I tried to deal other forms of alcohol. That didn't work out for me. I ended up, you know, using everything, and then I had some scary characters, you know, chasing me down for money and stuff like that. I was out of control. I cannot stop once I start, no matter what I do. it doesn't matter what the substance is, but you know, anyways, going on as I get older, same thing keeps happening. I just keep getting drunk. I mean, when I go out, I'll try. It's going to be different tonight. I'm not going to drink as much, change my brand, change my setting, you know, but the same result would always occur. I would always get recklessly drunk. You know, and to show, you know, how my thinking was warped, you know, I couldn't keep a wallet. I would get hammered, lose my wallet, or lose my phone. So I would get the Go phones, and then you'd get a SIM card for free, and you could pop a SIM card in the old Go phones. And I thought I was smarter than the system. I thought, you know, all the suckers are buying real phones and hanging on to their phones. You can get drunk as a skunk, lose your phone, have another one the next day for $15. It's no big deal. The same with my wallet. You know, it was just more to carry. And I would start to get a debit card and a driver's license, and I would get about 3 cards that I would just throw in my front pocket. And I felt like if I got up to about 4 or 5 cards, I was being pretty responsible. But I knew it was only a matter of time before drunks, you know, in the next couple drunks or however long, I'd be wiped out again. I'd be without the phone and the debit card and stuff. My alcoholic life seemed only a normal one, I guess. And I was so out of touch with reality and being a responsible adult. You know, the fact that I've never been mugged or robbed or something. I mean, there were so many nights I just kind of threw myself to the wind as far as the places I would carry myself. You know, I would go anywhere, and like I said, I'd be passed out on the bar or passed out in any place. I mean, thankfully, I'm not part of some human trafficking ring, because I mean, I was just a rag doll night after night, and I was a pass out drunk, and I hated that about myself. I wanted to be the drunk who could, you know, sit there and sit up with one eye open all night and just drink bottles of liquor or something. I couldn't do that. You know, I was a lightweight drunk, and that was like extra salt in the wound. That was some extra self-hatred, which is at the core of my disease. I couldn't be a heavyweight drunk. And I mean, you know, you have thinking when you think, well, I just need to drink more. I need to engage in this kind of like Olympic training of drinking. You know, the more I drink, the higher my tolerance goes, the less I'll get in trouble, right? I mean, same as when I was wrestling with this problem for the first time, coming to grips with my alcoholism, the way I was going to prove to myself and other people I didn't have a problem, I was going to drink. I'm going to prove I don't have an alcohol problem by doing some drinking. That's my thinking. That's the alcoholic thinking that I have. Where was I? Like I say, I'm just trying to get away from the chronological thing. I don't want to tell a drunk log tonight. I want to share what I've found since I've made it to these rooms, and I've found a lot. I feel like it's progress. And I get away from, you know, having to be perfect, having to do these steps perfectly, or do these parts, like juggling balls, like spiritual principles. Are these balls I've got to juggle, and if I don't juggle them perfectly, then I'm not going to grow. That's a bunch of bullshit. I'm just going to tell like it is. I don't know why. I'm just kind of like on edge emotionally tonight. I feel like I'm going to come apart at any second for some reason, and that's just because I'm real thankful for this program. This has changed my life. I mean, the life I live today, the things I do in my day-to-day, and like being responsible, showing up, work, family, beginning to be a friend among friends. Among friends, and I thought all they did was drink, and they had more to their lives than drinking. All I ever did was fucking drink, man. I was just a drunk. And, you know, I spent some time with some friends, and I thought they were doing the same thing as me. I spent some time with them yesterday. And apparently they're just not drunk. You know, they have like this other life that they live all the time. All I thought we were doing was drinking. But then I couldn't see past that. That's all it was, man. And like I say, I don't know why I'm kind of just like ready to unravel tonight. I don't know why, man. I've told my story, and you know, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't happen. I've had a lot of good advice prior to telling my story. Somebody said, I was telling somebody one night, I was like, I just really want to go do a good job tonight. And he's like, well, you know, it's not about you, right? It's about the newcomer here and the message. And it's like, well, thank you, man, you know, for helping me get it out of myself. But I'm going to try to proceed through this. Like I say, I'm just kind of right there on the edge tonight. Same thing kept happening. Late 20s, just, you know, a dangerous amount of blackouts. Like Tim was saying, my younger brother's in this program. He's 2 years younger than me. He's got 3 more years of recovery. You never know who's watching. I partied with him since we were young teenagers, and we were doing, you know, alcohol, among other forms of alcohol, in strong doses from, like, you know, 15 and 13 year old kids. I don't know why, man. That's weird. But I knew somebody else liked to use substances the way I did, and I knew there was life after alcohol because of his recovery. So you never know who's watching. Somebody in your life might be watching if you're recovering. And I happened to be watching him, you know, because my life was still a mess. I was a shit show, of course. And he asked me to talk on the phone. I lived out in Colorado, tried the geographical cure. I stole a car in Gainesville one night, you know, Grand Theft Auto, DUI. I didn't get caught for it that night. DUI, God, y'all know how it is, you know, 1,000 times probably. So I ran away, I tucked tail and left Gainesville, ran out to Colorado to run away from myself and start over and all that stuff. I brought me with me, same stuff kept happening, right? Same other forms of alcohol were out there available to me. But I would talk with him on the phone, and he said, "Man, how's your drinking going?" And I would have to answer like an alcoholic answers. "Oh, it's going." You know, I couldn't tell him it was going good because that was sure as hell was a lie. And then I couldn't say bad because that was too much honesty. It was too much truth. I couldn't be like, "Well, dude, it's a shit show. What do you think?" You know, I mean, same as always. I'm like, "Oh, it's going, man." You know. But anyways, I knew that I saw what he had. I saw the way he got to show up. He started showing up family-wise. He had self-respect. He had this kind of a swagger I'd never seen before. And it wasn't a swagger of like false pride. And that was such a part of my story. I was so full of false pride. That feeling less than, what I did to mask that, right, was I was a hot shot. I was the popular guy, the center of attention, all that stuff. I mean, I was always trying to be the belle of the ball kind of thing, and I'd get shit-faced. And, I mean, I can't tell you, like, say, you know, not being a heavyweight drinker, man. They've made cocoons out of me. I've had, like, the Sharpie to the worst degree so many times. But anyways, I'm kind of bouncing around. My younger brother, like I say, he was in this program, and I saw that there was another way of life. And after one of my drunks one night, and using other forms of alcohol in that drunk, I called him. I'd been up all night long, and I said, "Martin, you know, I've been up all night, and I want to go to an AA meeting. Am I allowed to go?" And he said, "If you feel like you need to go, man." And that was March 13th. 2015, and that was my first AA meeting, and that was St. Michael's Church in Denver, Colorado, and it was, I was just so happy to be there. I felt safe. I remember feeling very safe and feeling like, you know, it was over, or it could be over, my first meeting. I didn't stay sober that first meeting. Got sober for 3 months, and went back out. You know, maybe I made a too big deal about this thing. I had a couple drunks in a couple days. And I broke the rules that I'd made. I had this self-knowledge now from, you know, being around y'all. And learned so much about the way that I drink. You know, all this stuff in the big book talking about, that's the way I drank. Now I know what I'm, you know, what to look out for. And I'll kind of, I'll outmaneuver my alcoholism now. Thank you for the information. And that's what I was going to do. But the rules I had made in order to outmaneuver my alcoholism, I broke the rules instantly. And like I say, 2 drunks, 5 days. 2 shit-faced drunks, you know, typical, like I had any other kind. I was back in these rooms, and so I was back, and I stayed around for 5 months, and then I don't know what, you know, how I'd rationalize going back out again. I had the insanity of the first drink. I was going to a Halloween party, and I was going to be Rick James for Halloween, and I couldn't be Rick James and not be effed up was the logic. So I went back out, and the first time, again, alcoholic thinking, the first time I was out for 2 drunks in 5 days, and I said, "No, dude, you've got to stay out there and hurt like a man. You know, you've got to be out there and, you know, take the punches like a good alcohol takes. You know, I mean, you've got to toughen up and get on that drinking program and build your tolerance up and all that." And I was not going to come back to AA. Y'all were trying to brainwash me. and I didn't appreciate it. This was fucking with my head, and I was not coming back here. You know, it might get ugly out there, but I'm not coming back. And I decided that firmly. Within 1 month, I was back. I scared the hell out of myself. I was driving around drunk as hell, not knowing where I was going and stuff. And I thought, all right, 3 months, 5 months, I'm probably good for like 7 or 9. I might get a year now. This is progressive, like just like they say, you know, making progress. I didn't stay in the room for 1 month at that time. I was back out for New Year's Eve, and didn't get a DUI that night. Went out with friends, and you know, didn't have a bad night. Didn't get a DUI, and I was all better. And I'd make too big a deal about this thing, and so a week later, I was the only guy in a blue shirt in this Green Bay bar watching Green Bay football, just drinking, of course, and alone, and went out where I heard they had, you know, the Green Bay game on or something, and like I give two shits about Green Bay football, and got drunk as a skunk all day long, and totally out of flight with reality, you know, just totally drunk, and went driving off to the Pink Pony because, you know, I like football, but I really like the Pink Pony. And, didn't even know where the hell I was going pretty much when the cop pulled me over. After I hit the second car, the first car I'd bumped into, I convinced them that, you know, hey, let's exchange numbers. We'll talk about it tomorrow when it's daylight out, blah, blah, blah. And then the second car I hit a little bit harder, like not even 5 minutes later, driving around drunk as could be. And they said, you know, tell me if you're drinking, we won't call the cops. And I thought they were trying to trick me. And so I said, no, you can call them. You know, we're good. Let me run into the CVS and grab some gum. And so I go into the CVS, come outside. I'm totally drunk. I'm totally bewildered by all these blue lights going on. And they're trying to tell me I walked off from the scene. And, you know, he asked me to blow in the breathalyzer. And again, how out of touch I was. I thought, man, it's been hours ago since I had my last drink. I was drinking back in the afternoon. It's nighttime now. I've been drinking all afternoon into the nighttime. You know, like my last beer was 20 minutes ago. I've been drinking all day long, and I thought I was going to pass the breathalyzer. And like I say, my story, I don't want to get into all the war stories and stuff. I hope I've qualified myself enough. I blew like a .22 or something like that. I don't have like one of those super record awesome breathalyzers. Mine was .41 kind of shit. And I just wasn't one of those drunks who could, you know, sit there, you know, with nearly half my bloodstream full of alcohol. Part of why the other forms of alcohol appeal to me so much is I could be a heavyweight in those. I could really, you know, ride the tiger or whatever, all that kind of shit. I love to. I had such a chip on my shoulder. Still have that. I was drunk enough, certainly, for a DUI and went into jail. And that night in the jail cell, for the first time in my life, the idea that this alcohol thing's not working out for you crept into my mind for the first time in my life. It wasn't my mom's fault. It wasn't my dad's fault. It wasn't the man in the system. It wasn't the police. You know, the idea, like, I was, thankfully, I was in that jail cell by myself, because had I not been, had I had to share a cell in the drunk tank that night, I might have been too proud to break down and cry. But I was on my knees in that cot. And I just cried, and I thought, my God, you know, I mean, this drinking thing is not working. I'm ruining my life. And that thought also came into my head. Besides the thought that drinking is not working out for you, the very next thought that came into my head was, you are ruining your own life. Nobody else is ruining your life. You're doing it. And I guess maybe another thought was like, you better stop ruining your life before it's too late. Because, y'all, I've got the experience. I've gotten fired off more jobs than I can count on both my hands. Showing up late, showing up drunk and late, showing up, you know, not showing up. I mean, like I say, it's hard to get hired after you've been fired from about 3 jobs in a row and you can't give a reference because you're showing up drunk, or you show up reeking of booze, or, you know, not show up at all the things that we do that I always did. And like I say, I was rapidly getting painted into a corner by my alcoholism. And all the while, I've been in denial. I've been, like, denying all these glaring signs of alcoholism. And that DUI, thank Christ, was the knockout punch. I mean, it was just, I was in a corner, and And there was, I just had to look it in the face. And it happened that night in that jail cell. And, you know, people call that a moment of clarity. You can call it a first step, you know. But so I was back in the meeting that I had been going to before I left and went back out. And the guy that I appreciated his sharing and his experience, he happened to be sponsoring that night, or happened to be chairing that night, and he said, "If you're looking for a sponsor, get with me, out of me." I was like, "That's perfect, that's meant to be." And I went and I was like, "Hey man, will you be my sponsor?" He's like, "Whoa, whoa, down boy." You know, and he's like, "Yeah, I'll be your sponsor. All right, we'll start working." And he told me to read the big book. I started to read the big book, and for the first time, I'd read the big book before, been reading in it, but I read it with an open mind, or an open heart, I guess. And man, I was reading about myself page after page, and I was making these notes on the side of the paragraphs, and like, is this you? Have you felt this way? Do you, you know? And man, I was reading the big book, and I say, man, tears are falling out of my eyes onto the pages of that book, and I was just so ready for this. And you know, we did the first step, we did the second and third. The third step was really cool for me. I had this epiphany, right? And the third step, and this is just not up to you, Zach. You know, it was such an ingenious idea. It made life, continues to make life so much easier. It's just not up to me. Some people talk about the third step, the decision to do the rest of the steps or whatever. Everybody interprets it their own way. But, you know, like I say, the spiritual experiences to me are incremental. My first spiritual experience was the honesty of alcohol's not working out in your life. That was like an epiphany, you know, spiritual in nature. And I guess the second noticeable epiphany, this spiritual awakening I had was, you know, you're not the center of all things, man. You know, things just don't have to happen according to you. And so that was the third step for me. And my sponsor said, be ready to do your fourth step when you pick up your 90-day chip. And I said, okay. And my mom set me up with this girl. And I was like, well, my mom set me up. You know, I got to go on the date because my mom set me up. And he's like, all right, we'll go on the date and just tell her, you know, you had a great time, but, you know, you just don't need to do that. Well, I didn't listen to that. And so I was, you know, I was ready to start my fourth step when I got my 90-day chip. But I was, you know, I started dating this girl, and I'd begun to use this girl for companionship, for sex, for a date, for pride. You know, hey, you know, I've got a date to the wedding or what, blah, 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 wherever I'm going. And I picked up my 6 months chip in this program, having just finally gotten the guts to break it off with her. I mean, we dated for 4 or 5 months, but I knew I didn't really care for her. But I said, well, I don't know, I'll just, you know, maybe I'll feel something in a little while. I knew I didn't feel anything. I just wanted to continue to use that girl. And I finally had the guts to, you know, be honest enough to be like, listen, we don't need a date because I don't, you know, I didn't tell her I don't care about you. I tried to be as civil and as forthcoming and honest as possible. But I picked up my yellow chip, and I realized I could pick up a half a year sobriety and be a total piece of shit. Or be a total jerk, asshole, whatever you want. I mean, I felt this big, and I cried after I broke up with that girl because it was just so, like, in my face, raw, who I was. And I didn't have alcohol, you know. I'm beginning to learn that, you know, alcohol's not the only problem. Zach, you know, Zach's the problem. And that was kind of like what came to the jail cell that night. But by the grace of God, I didn't go back out. Because I do the other times I've been in AA, I did the 1-2-3 drink, the old AA shuffle. 1-2-3 drink, 1-2-3 drink. 4 was a brick wall to me. And by the grace of God, it took me 6 months to do my step 4. I think I was, you know, doing my step 5 when I picked up my my 9 months chip. And, you know, instead of going back out there like I did before, I went further into the program by the grace of God. I mean, I don't know why else. You know, when I finally picked up that pen and started putting it into paper, I didn't understand the fourth column. The three columns were in the book, and, you know, that fourth column, my part in it, I was like, well, wait a second, their part, the cause, hello. You know, like, there is no fourth column because of the second column, the cause and their part. Do you not see what they did to me? I could not get past that blockage. And, you know, like I say, grace of God. I had willingness, and I just, well, I'm just going to try to write something. And Dad was at the very top of my list. And I was like, I'm just going to write something, man. And, you know, I started trying to write well, trying turned into writing. And all of a sudden, you know, like this pen is just taking off across the paper with my part in it, with my relationship with my dad, who, you know, was number one on my resentment list. And, you know, by the end of this thing, I'm crying and, like, I'm forgiving my dad for not being the perfect role model. And I'm admitting that I've been using this all my life to, you know, be reckless, irresponsible, all the ways that I used my resentment against him. And it was like, holy shit. And I had the courage to do the rest of the, you know, the fourth column of the fourth step. And I went to share this with my sponsor, my fifth step. And, you know, poor guy, I had to talk his head off all Saturday. And, you know, as we were getting through these resentments and stuff, we were making it to the, and I have like these pages, right? I mean, you know, multiple pages of resentments. And I had in my hands these pages of shit, like literal, like rotten, no good stuff I'm hanging on to. And it's like in like a physical form. And the thought occurs to me, like, why am I hanging on to this stuff? And I just had my resentments in my hands, and I just kind of felt the futility of hanging on to this stuff. And my sponsor, like, offered me this wonderful advice or experience in these resentments I was dealing with. You know, against, like, institutions and stuff. He said, I tell you what, man. I tell you, all this stuff you're resenting itself kind of, like, out here. Like, you know, the media or the government. Why don't you just bring it in right here? And just, you know, just stuff that's kind of right in your sphere. Why don't you just deal with that stuff and not worry? And it's like, man, that's such a great idea. How come I didn't think of that? And he said, you know, I'm noticing something about all your fears. You know, all your fears are all out there too, man. He's like, why don't you just bring it right into here? And then it seems like, you know, every fear you had was out in the future. Like, holy shit. But anyways, well, what I'm trying to say is the steps, you know, that step, the fifth step was a revelation. Six and seven, boy, I'd love to tell y'all how well I do with those. I'm actually got a sponsee who came with me tonight, thank God, because I forgot my wallet and I wouldn't have the gas to get here, but my sponsee was with me. And anyways, it's really cool. I mean, so when I started to get sober in Denver in the restaurant I was working in, I realized how much I had built substances into my life. Because when I started to get sober, like, everywhere I turned was a drink or a hit or whatever. And 4 years on the other side of the coin in sobriety, I've got sobriety built into my life. And before I picked up my sponsee tonight, some guy called me. He had relapsed. I mean, it just really kind of got me in the zone talking to somebody else. And then I'm picking up a sponsee, and it's getting me out of myself, and I'm not even have to worry about the fact that I got to tell my story or something. And I mean, I guess, you know, what I'm trying to say about that is just thank God for y'all teaching me and these being around these rooms and building all this stuff into my life that helps, you know, to give insurance against taking the first drink, man. Everything would be lost. That's something I've always said for myself as I've been in, since I've been in recovery, is the stakes get higher. I got so much more to lose. You know, I've grown such a life. Since I haven't been a drunk anymore, I've got so much to piss away now. If I was a drunk like I was back then, but I've got so much in place bolstering up, you know, me not doing that. You know, there's so many things I'm appreciative for in this program, and being able to sponsor guys is certainly one of them. It gets me in the steps, and my sponsees in step six and seven right now. We're in Drop the Rock right now. And I read through it when I was in 6 and 7, but, you know, that's one of those things we're talking about tonight. The longest journey in this whole program is the head to the heart. And, you know, reading about that stuff and reading about how I'm going to act better sure is easy. You know, when it comes down for me to actually act better, you know, that's where the rubber hits the road. And it's just so good having guys who are, you know, coming in with the rawness of you know, getting their ass kicked or something, you know, and reminding me what it was like. And getting to work with people and keeping this thing fresh. And, you know, because this thing's still out here. I mean, people are getting their ass kicked tonight. You know, it's taking people every night of the week. And, you know, and it doesn't have to be like that anymore. And I was just so upset. I was talking to the guy I was talking to on the phone before I came here, how upset emotionally I was before I got here. And, you know, this sweet little lady told me when I walked in these rooms, you know, she's like, you don't have to drink anymore, sweetie. And I was so upset. All I could think was, fuck you. You don't know me. I mean, that's all I could think. I mean, I was so distraught. I was so at odds with a higher power today that I have a relationship with that, you know, if there's one spiritual tool I do right or absolutely regularly, it's prayer. I pray every morning and night. And, you know, even if I didn't do it right, it still works. But when I do it, I mean it, and I have this relationship with a higher power, my understanding, and I'm so thankful for it. And, you know, it's not up to me. I mean, I'm living a life on life's terms, and my higher power's everywhere. And life is so beautiful. I mean, I was missing out on all these things I see today that, like I say, I missed out on these. Like, even friends that I used to party with. You know, I mean, like I say, I thought it was all the drink. And, I mean, there was, I mean, I'm just seeing so many things that I was missing out on, because I just thought it was all the substances. And God, I was missing out. And life today is meaningful. I've got purpose. You know, if you'd have told me in the beginning, you know, that my purpose would be to, you know, help the next person to live life, you know, one day at a time, and not have to take a drink or any other form of alcohol in order to get by, I might not have been convinced that was enough, but thank God I stuck around long enough. I mean, that is so enough for me. That's plenty enough purpose for this alcoholic. And I do. I love getting to be here and be of service and be close to the solution. And you see the light turning on people's eyes, seeing the people opening up to this way of life. The miracles, I understand it. There was a guy named Don out in Denver. And he said to me, he said, Zach, you know, you got to stick around long enough for the miracle to happen. And I don't know what the hell he was talking about, but I understand the miracle now, as I now enjoy my life without alcohol and other substances more than I did. And that was impossible. It was an absolute impossibility. And that's what I thought, you know, the brainwashing was all about. I thought, no way. There's no way. That, I mean, that's a prison sentence. For me to walk this earth and not be effed up is a prison sentence. And I did not believe you with all of my heart, and I don't know how. You know, maybe it was the 12 steps, and I know I haven't talked about 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, but I don't know how, and, you know, I think it's happened incrementally, and I don't know, you know, that you can pick out a point in the road where it happened, but at some point, the miracle has happened to me. I love my life today without others. Alcohol as well as other substances. I love life being, you know, sober. It means everything to me. I had no idea that the very thing that I thought I needed to live life to get by, alcohol, was the very thing that was killing my life. My life couldn't, like, live. It couldn't grow up and get started up because I kept killing it off. I kept pouring alcohol over it. You know, I just kill it down every time it would try to grow. And I was so unused to, like, life growing and having healthy life that it was scary early in recovery. I thought, you know, this is too good to be true, man. Like, I'm about to, something bad is about to happen because this is too good for me. I'm a fuck up. That was my identity because that's what I did. Fuck stuff up in opportunities and relationships. And I don't have to do that anymore. I've got to make amends, you know, and they didn't. Some of them went really well. Some of them did not go like I expected at all. You know, those lists I made back in 4 and 5 were helpful, you know, making list number 8. And I've had the chance to take inventory a couple more times since that initial inventory. And often I find that I'm putting off taking inventory because it's more convenient. And I just have to wait until I hurt bad enough. I mean, that's where I'm at, you know, with so many things, with my behavior and dealing. When I talk to my sponsor, he'll just say, man, sounds like it's still working for you right now, man. You know, when I really start to hurt badly enough, I'll do something about it. And like I say again, the grace of my higher power with this alcoholism, I hurt badly enough without killing myself. I mean, why I didn't run into a brick wall or an oak tree or something on any of those 1,500 nights beats me. You know, I mean, I think it's because I do have a purpose, and that's so I can carry this message. thank you all so much for having me. I know I was a little all over the place tonight, but if I could say anything, is I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for this program from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you, Zach. That was raw truth, and we appreciate it. I know I do. I got a pretty good idea that I'm not going to take a drink tonight. And a part of that is you coming down here and telling your story. Terry, would you mind giving out chips? Got them laid out right here.
Terry, not an alcoholic.
Hey, Terry.
Thank you, Zach.
Got them all lined up for me. So if you're tired of the high cost of low living, we'd like to give you an opportunity to come up here and pick up a white chip that just represents your willingness to try to make a beginning in this program one day at a time. Anybody want to pick up a white chip? So we'd like to give a 30-day chip. You know, 30 days sobriety. 30 nights. Can't just do it in the daytime. Got to do it at night, too. So we have a gold chip for 60 days, right?
Yep.
All right. 60 days. Tried to throw me a curve, didn't you? All right. Anybody at 60 days? We have a red chip for 90 days. It's not mandatory by the judge. You say you got 90 days, I got you a red chip right here. All right. We have a yellow chip for 6 months. We have a green chip for 9 months. We have a blue chip for anniversaries, 365 days.
All right. I'm Brunella, I'm an alcoholic. I got 1 year. And I did it just by taking suggestions. I had to have a higher power of my own understanding, because I tried to do it on my own willpower, and it didn't work. I couldn't do it. Because I'm a real alcoholic. So I came in and I started listening to the stuff that you guys were saying. Get a sponsor. Get a home group. Do this stuff. The stuff that I didn't really listen to in the beginning. But it works. Anybody want a hope chip? Anybody need some hope? Thank you.
Anybody else celebrating an anniversary? So we offer a white chip one more time. Anybody else have a second thoughts? Anybody just wake up and realize you're in an AA meeting? Congratulations on the chips, you hope.
Thank you, Terry. A gentleman by the name of Kendall Lockerman has passed, and he's been with us at the NABA Club at the Thursday night men's meeting for decades now. Incredible poet. And he's considered the poet laureate of his church. Has had an impact in so many people's lives. Anyway, his funeral is February 1st, St. Mark's Episcopal Church. So that's February 1st at 1 p.m. Kendall Lockerman. Okay, so thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting tonight. Thank you.
Broadway. We'll all be together on that broad highway.